From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks, check it out.
Pixar's Brad Bird just received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Writers Guild, so this week on The Business, we revisit our conversation with the creator of The Incredibles and Ratatouille, plus the entertainment industry's home team. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. In Disney's heyday, animated films were works of art, with 1940's Fantasia perhaps their crowning achievement. But Disney lost their animation mojo for decades until the early 90s, when they got reanimated with the help of new computer technology, starting with Beauty and the Beast.
A little scared, not a one prepared.
They went on to crank out a string of musical hits through the decade, but while Aladdin and The Lion King and others made money, their trademark, soft-around-the-edges, Disneyfied sensibility reinforced the idea of animated features as cartoons for kids. By about 2000, Disney's animated films started showing diminishing returns, and other studios had entered the animated act big time.
Shrek.
That was really scary. And if you don't mind me saying, you definitely need some Tic Tacs or something, because your breath stinks.
But back in 1991, Disney had made a prescient three-picture deal with a Northern California computer company called Pixar. Their first film, Toy Story, came out in 1995. It used fantastic new computer-generated graphics and great storytelling and characters, and it began to change feature animation as we know it.
For anyone who's ever wondered what toys do when people aren't around.
Hey, everybody! It's showtime!
Walt Disney Pictures invites you into a world where toys come to life.
Toy Story was a great movie for kids, and it was perfect for the kind of promotional and licensing deals that were Disney's bread and butter. But Toy Story was not just a movie for kids by any means. 8 successful features and 46 Oscar nominations later, if you include their shorts and scientific awards, Pixar has become the stuff of Hollywood legend. Their success not only changed how the business and audiences felt about animation, but how the Motion Picture Academy dealt with it. They created the Best Animated Feature category in 2001. But what makes Pixar so successful? In a word, they're people. That's really two words, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, one of those people is Brad Bird, who wrote and directed their 2004 hit The Incredibles and their newest film, Ratatouille, the story of a rat who loves to cook.
First of all, I'm a rat. Which means life is hard. And second, I have a highly developed sense of taste and smell.
Brad Bird's been in animation for a very long time. When he was only 14, he sent his first homemade animated film to Disney Studios. They were so impressed that they invited him to come by and learn from Milt Kahl, one of the original Disney animators known as the Nine Old Men. So when Pixar was bought by Disney in 2006, it was a homecoming of sorts. The business host Claude Brodesser-Ackner spoke to Brad Bird from Pixar Studios in Northern California.
In some ways, he probably was not an ideal teacher candidate because he was volatile and he tended to frighten a lot of people that he worked with because he had very strong opinions and he wasn't shy about voicing them. You know, any illusions I had about thinking that I was, you know, hot stuff were quickly dashed by just going into the lion's den with these guys.
Now, you've said that Milt Kahl specifically taught you, and I'm quoting you here, animation must always be the best graphic representation of an idea, end quote. you know, whether that's courage or evil or cowardice or whatever. And that seemed like a very sophisticated concept, even for a 14-year-old wunderkind. I mean, did you understand that at the time, or did it come later?
You know, he personified it in what he said to me, but more importantly, his work personified it. You know, he would say to me, you know, you haven't even explored the possibilities. And that's one thing to say that criticism. But then I looked at how he worked, and he was constantly exploring. I mean, every single pose that he was drawing, he tried, you know, 15, 20 different ways in little sketches. And the relentlessness of that, the fact that he was never resting on his laurels or being lazy, that he was always pushing, made a big impact on me.
Can you give me an example of, like, one of your characters that you could literally point to and say, that's because of Milt Kahl?
If you want to have an example for Ratatouille, there's a moment where the chef, the little evil chef Skinner, right after the restaurant critic has eaten the ratatouille and really likes it, where the Skinner character tastes the ratatouille and he wants them to fail. He tastes it and it tastes really good, and that makes him really angry and mystified and all of these things at once. You know, you're seeing enjoyment, total anger, and total how can this happen, all in the space of a couple of seconds. But it's having very clear ideas of what you want to convey and then finding a way so that the audience sees them without exaggerating them too much.
Well, speaking of Ratatouille, which is, we should point out, nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Animated Feature and Screenplay, I want to ask you, what do you think of the category of Best Animated Feature Film?
Well, you know, I'm gratified that people are acknowledging the fact that a lot of really interesting movies are animated. At the same time, there is somewhat of a feeling like you're being set off to one side as if we are not also film. But I think that that's changing as well. And the fact that it was nominated for screenplay and music and sound along with other live action films tells me that perceptions are changing. So, you know, it's saying that it's a separate kind of filmmaking, and that's only process. Storytelling is storytelling, no matter what your medium is. And the language of film is also the same. You're still using close-ups and medium shots and long shots, and you're still trying to introduce the audience to a character and get them to care. I don't know. I feel uncomfortable, though, because any recognition and honor is very touching and welcome.
You mentioned earlier, you know, the idea of being a part in terms of Oscar recognition. But it also seems like Pixar's success comes from it not being part of Hollywood in any way.
Certainly, if the idea for Ratatouille had been, you know, if it were only done on the basis of it being easy to sell, it never would have gotten the green light, ever. It's cooking and France and rats, and none of these areas are high concept ideas. But the fact that Pixar would go ahead with it just based on, you know, they found the idea entertaining and they felt that they could make a good film out of it, something that would be intriguing and unusual, that was the entire basis of their decision. They didn't go out and get a bunch of pie charts and figure out that this was going to surf the next wave. You know, it's a very old-fashioned, actually, way of approaching the movie business. It's kind of all built around gut instinct of like, hey, do I like that idea? Great, let's make it. It's not any more complicated than that. And that's really rare nowadays. And I can't tell you really why, because everybody has all these all this research being done. And yet I don't see any higher percentage of hits being made. And nobody seems to acknowledge that, you know, that instinct is at least as good and almost always better than all of this sort of computerized data and pre-testing of titles and all this sort of ridiculousness that makes people feel secure but shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. What is it specifically about the process that cannot, for whatever reason, be replicated down south 500, 600 miles, whatever it is?
the bottom line is there is going to be, you know, at some point a film that doesn't, you know, do as well as we'd like it to do. And we still hopefully won't regard that as a failure. You know, we'll, you know, only two of Disney's first five movies, all of which are regarded as classics today, made money on their initial release. You know, only Snow White and Dumbo did. Bambi and Pinocchio and Fantasia were all financial failures. And that seems impossible to think of now. If you look at them adjusted for inflation, they're among the most successful films ever made. But it took time for them to find their audience. And I think that catering to an audience or trying to cash in on a trend or anything like that, I think that you're headed for trouble. And I think one of the most refreshing things about Pixar is that they don't feel that they've figured it out. They just feel like they're the happiest with this model, which is a lot about instinct and a lot about what would we like to see on the screen. Lasseter says quality is the best business policy, and I agree with that.
But you also have the luxury of time that feature films, live-action films, don't have.
Yeah, the movie business is very complicated, and oftentimes things get rushed because of other things, the star's availability, or they don't have a big film for the Christmas, you know, 2010 slot or something like that. And that seems to dictate what gets made. That said, you know, animation is complicated in many ways that live action is not, too. We don't get anything for free. We have to build every single thing you see on screen and have meetings discussing each thing and the texture of each thing. And, you know, some of it will be easier and some of it will probably be harder. But it's all filmmaking and all storytelling, and I'm really excited about it.
If you're just joining us, I'm Matt Holzman, and this is The Business. Our usual host, Claude Bardesser-Ackner, is talking with Brad Bird, the writer and director of the Pixar animated hits The Incredibles and Ratatouille.
Well, let's talk about where animation is headed. You've also said that there's a contingent of the digital effects community, and I'm quoting you here, to whom the holy grail is to create photographically real humans. To me, that is the dumbest goal you could possibly have, end quote. And so I wonder, like, what do you make of a director like Robert Zemeckis trying to do Polar Express or Beowulf?
Well, first of all, I think Zemeckis is a brilliant filmmaker, and a lot of my favorite films were directed by him. So here's my problem with that particular technique right now. Now, I think it's a valuable tool. Mm-hmm. I think that it is, and there is a place for it. I mean, I think Peter Jackson has used motion capture very well. What I think is strange is that, for me, it's neither fish nor fowl. In other words, it doesn't have the nuance of real live action, and it doesn't have the caricature of animation. So I think that if you use it as a starting point and then mess with it, like Peter Jackson does, you can get amazing results. But I think that the closer you try to adhere to making it just kind of transferring an actor's performance to a slightly different body, I don't know. Jury's still out for me. I think that there are better ways to use that tool.
You know, speaking of sort of feelings about movies, you once said, I love the medium of film. But that the strange dichotomy of film is that the medium is so unbelievably magical and wonderful, and the business is so ugh. And I don't know if I'm translating ugh with the right amount of disgust, but you know, I'm just curious to ask you, like, what is it about the business that's most ugh to you?
Well, I mean, it's incredibly hard to get people to feel comfortable with investing resources on anything, you know, that, I mean, I guess it's because when you're talking about an idea or something you want to see on screen, it's, you're in a very light sort of absorbed mode that's almost childlike. And the business part of it is all this bureaucratic nonsense. And basically you're trying to keep people from being frightened. You know, people, you know, that want to keep their parking space. So the last thing they want to do is something that sounds remotely risky. So you're constantly trying to package your stuff to sound familiar and safe so that they will, you know, give you the resources to go ahead. And I just kind of wish that it was judged on that level, because the pie chart mentality is so not what makes movies special, you know. The business school graduate wants to feel that there's a repeatable, dependable set of circumstances that will always yield a hit. And the truth of the matter is, this is a gamble. Everybody's just kind of shrugging their shoulders and going, seems cool to me. I mean, it's all made on a very instinctive sort of childlike level. And I think that you either join that party or you don't, you stay away from it. And I hate them trying to impose business school logic on something as dreamlike as film. You just can't do it. And again, I don't see anybody having more consistent success not trusting their instincts than people who do. And you either have instinct or you don't. And if you have it, this is a business for you. If you don't, you know, go make widgets.
Well, we got to leave it there. Brad Bird is the writer and director of Ratatouille, nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Animated Feature and Best Screenplay. He also wrote and directed the Oscar-winning film The Incredibles. Brad, thanks for being on The Business.
It's been fun. Thanks.
Here's Brad Bird as the voice of designer to the superheroes Edna Mode in The Incredibles, a role I believe should have earned him a Best Supporting Actor nomination. Actress nomination? Actor nomination?
I cut it a little roomy for the free movement. The fabric is comfortable for sensitive skin. It can also withstand a temperature of over 1,000 degrees. Completely bulletproof. And machine washable, darling. That's a new feature.
What on earth do you think the baby will be doing?
Well, I'm sure I don't know, darling. Luck favors the prepared. I didn't know the baby's powers, so I covered the basics.
Jack-Jack doesn't have any powers.
No? Well, could look fabulous anyway.
A postscript. The 9 old men I referred to in the intro to our Brad Bird interview were the original Disney animators, the creative heart and soul of Disney's animation heyday. On April 15th, Ollie Johnston, the last of the surviving 9 old men, passed away at the age of 95. Johnston began his career on Disney's first feature film, 1937's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Someday my prince will come. Someday we'll meet again. And away to his castle.
Coming up after a short break, the entertainment industry home team. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner.
In celebration of the L.A. Lakers' somewhat surprising advancement to the playoffs, we thought we'd revisit my look at the entertainment industry's home team. The mascot of the Boston Celtics is Lucky the Leprechaun. The Denver Nuggets have Rocky the Mountain Lion. But the Los Angeles Lakers have Jack, the movie star.
Well, and it was Jack Nicholson's surprise birthday kink that has been one of the highlights for Laker fans already in this game.
Jack Nicholson is the metaphoric heart of the Lakers, and his seats are a kind of physical landmark for any true Lakers fan. Craig Baumgarten is a longtime Lakers season ticket holder and a producer who ran Columbia and Lorimar Pictures in the 80s.
The entertainment industry team is and has been the Lakers for quite some time. You know, that's the entertainment industry home team.
Denzel Washington, Mike Ovitz, DreamWorks Animation CEO Jeffrey Katzenberg, billionaire media mogul Chaim Saban, and Eagles frontman Glenn Frey are just a handful of the showbiz biggies who shell out $2,200 a seat for the privilege of sitting on the floor during a Lakers game. John Black is the Lakers PR guy.
Courtside seats, we have 124. You know, the 124 most exclusive seats in all of sports.
No matter what they cost, the floor seats owned by Endeavor super agent Ari Emanuel and William Morris CEO Jim Wyatt are a great investment.
I know the Knicks used to have 8 courtside seats, which they would give away to celebrities, which was mind-blowing to me, because if I had 8 courtside seats to give away for every game, I would own this town.
It's unclear by what method the agencies and studios dole out their seats. One can only imagine the morning meeting at Endeavor or William Morris before the playoffs as the agents try to make the case for why their client should get them. What may come as a shock to you is that many of the celebrities you see in the front row of Lakers games don't actually care about basketball. Joe Smith is the former head of Warner Brothers, Capitol, and Elektra Records, and a longtime holder of Lakers season tickets. On the floor, of course.
I explained to some of the people on the floor that there's 5 men on a team and a basket counts for 2 points.
There's maybe 2 feet between the front row and the row behind it, but in Los Angeles, it might as well be a mile.
On the floor is a big difference from one row back, I must tell you, in terms of the bullshit prestige that goes on in this city.
Producer Craig Baumgarten.
A big-time actor, you know, who's used to going on the floor seats, I probably won't ask him. My seats are better than floor seats, in my opinion, for seeing the game.
The front row isn't just for the A-list. Having People magazine take your picture sitting on floor seats at a Laker game has become a kind of rite of passage for the up-and-coming star, the Lakers' John Black.
I got a call from people asking about Lindsay Lohan, who came to a game recently, and I really didn't know the answers to, you know, where she got the tickets from, and they wanted to know who she came with, what did she have to eat.
The question is, why do the stars love the Lakers? Why not the Dodgers or the Kings? Well, first of all, the Lakers are winners, and L.A. loves a winner. But maybe more importantly, in basketball, there's nothing between you and the court and the photographers. But if you want to see the real reason that the Lakers are the entertainment industry home team, take your eyes off Jack and Denzel for a minute and look a few rows back.
In the section I'm in are a lot of people in the business, and there's a lot of, like, glad handing and stuff.
Adam Merrims is a producer who shares those seats 13 rows behind Jack Nicholson with Craig Baumgarten. The sections just off the floor where they sit is a seething mass of agents, producers, directors, and everyone else who puts in the business in show business.
It's like an old adage in the business, you know, meet a new friend and make a closer one at every event you go to. And, you know, certainly that applies to Laker games.
Of course, no matter where you go, you'll find businessmen bonding over a beer at a basketball game. But the ball takes on a whole new spin in show business, especially with the insecure creative types. Back when they were working on a project together, Adam Merrims asks screenwriter Mark Mullen to a game.
Yeah, I was pretty blown away. He calls me up and says, hey, we're going to a playoff game tonight. And I'm just going, whoa.
In a town where the gift is an all-important element of the business, good seats to a big game can be the ultimate gift.
Fruit baskets, bottles of wine. I've had people send, when my daughter was born, a producer I was in business with sent a lovely blanket for my daughter. I'm having to jar my memory, but the Laker game comes right to mind.
Mark Mullen's a huge basketball fan, so he's not waiting for the call. He has his own season tickets to the Los Angeles Clippers.
Screenwriters go to Clippers games, and big-time directors and actors and producers and Jack Nicholson go to go to Lakers games.
We end our show with words of wit and wisdom and cynicism from writer and producer Rob Long.
I know someone who works in advertising, and on his first week on the job, years ago, a more seasoned copywriter took him aside to give him some advice. They were both on their way to the creative director's office to pitch him some ideas for a new campaign. Now, listen, when you pitch your stuff to the big guy, the seasoned copywriter said, don't put on a big razzle-dazzle, don't make a big sales thing. Jim hates that. He just hates it. You just go in there, you take your copy, you put it on his desk, and you let him read it. Don't say a word. So my friend goes into the office with his copy. He walks up to the creative director's desk. He gently puts it down in front of him, and he waits. The creative director looks baffled and then irritated. He then picks up the copy. He gives it a desultory read, and then he puts it aside. Okay, he says, I've read that. And then he turns to the more seasoned copywriter. What have you got? He asks. Well, Jim, says the seasoned copywriter, here's what I've got. And then he springs to life. Fade in, he says. A golden morning. The dew-flecked wheat tosses and waves in the gentle breeze. And then what's that? A simple melody on the piano. It's warm, like the morning sunlight. And then into frame a glistening silver Greyhound bus. A handsome boy in an army uniform watches intently out of the window. A smiling bus driver. An old lady knitting gives the boy a wink. And the bus pulls up to a bright red and white diner. He steps out. The piano melody becomes warmer, softer. And then there she is, his girl. They embrace. The other passengers watch them, smiling and cheering. The bus pulls away. Greyhound. Because it's good to be home. Well, you know how this turns out, right? The seasoned copywriter gets the raise, and my friend learns a valuable lesson. One of the first rules of show business is never go first. Now, I thought of that this week when I heard about an actor I know who fired his agent. What he said in public was, well, I just felt like I was a little more in sync with, and here he named his new agent and the new agency. But in private, what he was telling everyone was that his old agent was just too negative, just too pessimistic, just too much of a downer. And this actor only wants to be surrounded by upbeat optimists, by positive attitudes. But what he didn't know, and what I'm certainly not going to be the one to tell him either, is that for the past year or so, his manager... You see, a lot of actors have managers and agents, and sometimes they all get along, but mostly, because of credit issues and producers' fee issues and package fee issues, they don't get along. And in this case, they really didn't get along. So for the past year, the actor's manager was telling the actor's agent, you know what the actor likes about you? You're honest. You're a straight shooter. You tell it like it is. You're cautious, and you always make sure he's aware of the downside of any decision. So for the past year, the agent has been really laying it on thick with the actor. You know, saying things like, this isn't going to work, or this project isn't going to go, or that movie's too expensive, or that director isn't a fan, until finally the actor had had enough. So he fired the agent and told his manager to help him find another one. Which the manager did. A new agent, one that's upbeat and positive, and especially one that's grateful to the manager and easygoing. With the manager about things like credit and package fees and producer's fees. And that's another one of those show business rules. Never let somebody else tell you what somebody else really wants.
Rob Long is a writer and producer working in Hollywood. And that's The Business. I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by